This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 1st. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's top story, top of the fold. Triangle, Charlotte, could share 1,000 jobs. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle and is from Durham. MetLife Incorporated, the largest U.S. life insurer, is considering the creation of more than 1,000 additional jobs in North Carolina, splitting expanded operations between facilities in the Triangle and in Charlotte, say people familiar with the plan. Any deal could be contingent on an aggressive economic development incentives package from state and local governments. Sources say representatives of MetLife have been touring office buildings and negotiating with state officials for at least 4 months. The recruitment effort has been labeled Project Magellan by economic developers. In the Triangle, MetLife officials have toured several office properties that could accommodate a lease request for 100,000 square feet or more in the Danbury Hall office building in the Imperial Center Business Park in Durham, and the two former Sony Ericsson buildings on Development Drive in Research Triangle Park. Danbury Hall has 118,757 square feet of office space that is currently 100% occupied by Fidelity Investments. Fidelity, however, will vacate the building after its lease expires at the end of March as it expands and consolidates its operations in the Triangle to its newly renovated Gateway Center campus in Research Triangle Park. The former Sony Ericsson buildings at 7001 and 8001 Development Drive each have more than 200,000 square feet of space, and both have been vacant for more than 3 years. At Danbury Hall, Tri-Properties partner Clay Stober says he couldn't confirm whether MetLife is one of the companies whose representatives have toured the building. I have conducted 3 tours in the last 2 weeks with tenants that would not submit their names, Stober says. That's been the big joke around here. You can tour Danbury, but you can't give us your name. Tri-Properties has been the leasing and property management agency for Danbury Hall since it was built in 2002. In South Charlotte, MetLife is in talks to lease one of two new 10-story buildings at Ballantyne Corporate Park, according to a report in the Charlotte Business Journal, a sister publication. The Ballantyne building, each total 276,120 square feet, and were recently completed. MetLife is being represented by the Cushman & Wakefield Tallheimer real estate firm. MetLife spokesman John Calagna told the Charlotte Business Journal that the New York City-based company is undergoing a review of its real estate footprint across the country, which includes strategies around consolidating and exiting certain locations. We are in the process of conducting due diligence on these locations and do not have any additional information to provide at that point, Caligna says. To date, no legislation has been filed in the North Carolina General Assembly that would authorize special incentives to lure the MetLife jobs to North Carolina. Sources have estimated that the company's capital investment would be around $30 million. MetLife does not currently have a major office location in the Carolinas, although it does have sales offices and sales representatives across the state. If MetLife were to expand into the Triangle, it would be in good company by following other financial services firms, including Fidelity Investments and Credit Suisse Deutsche Bank, that have each opened regional offices in the Triangle in the past 8 years and collectively employed more than 2,500 people in the region. Today's cover story, part one, "It's a Different World," says retired IBM exec. This article is by Lauren K. Onisores and is from Morrisville. Retired IBM executive Richard Daugherty has been watching operations at Lenovo, but from a distance. "It's a different world," he says. "It makes me feel good to see that something we started years ago, way back in the 80s, has grown into the size business it was when IBM sold it, and now even grown further under the auspices of Lenovo." When IBM announced in 2005 it had sold its RTP-based personal computing business to Lenovo, 1,800 local IBM workers, 10,000 altogether, were included in the deal, and it was big news. The new company would be a subsidiary of Lenovo, officials said at the time, based in New York with major operations at Lenovo's base of Beijing and in RTP. The deal ends an era at IBM, which revolutionized the computing world when it introduced its PC in 1981, read an article in Triangle Business Journal's December 8, 2004 issue. Instantly, the deal created the world's third-largest seller of PCs. The company name is new to North Carolina, but the people are not. Bill Owens, Lenovo's then vice president of service and support, said in 2005, "In 5 years, I'm confident we will reflect on this significance to the state." Initially, Lenovo moved its new workers into 4 buildings in the Park Center Office Park and 3 buildings in Pinnacle Park on Silicon Drive. In 2005, the company announced it would build an $84 million campus at Perimeter Park in Morrisville, agreeing to create up to 400 additional jobs by 2009. Staying in the Triangle was precipitated by more than $11 million in tax incentives from the One North Carolina Fund, a job development investment grant, Morrisville and Wake County. The company had initially requested $14 million in incentives from state and local governments, but state and Wake County officials said Lenovo has not collected any of the incentives. Over the years, the company, which has added about 400 positions, has taken fewer tax credits than did IBM, which, of course, had much more going on here than in its PC business. In 2008, IBM took more than $3 million in state research and development tax credits. In 2009, Lenovo took just $53,297 in similar credits. In 2010, Lenovo claimed $595,186 in R&D tax credits and followed with $41,441 in 2011. Lenovo has since expanded its North Carolina footprint. Its new manufacturing facility in Whitsitt near Greensboro started production in February and is making laptops and PCs, depending on what orders come in, according to company representative Malanka Mukhi. Jay Parker, Lenovo's North American president, says that despite recent reorganizations, the company is committed to its local workforce. "That will continue," he says. "That's not changing. It will only scale with growth." And while he won't speculate on acquisition rumors, he does say Lenovo is staying the course. As for Daughtry, while he's paying attention, he offers no advice, adding that Lenovo is doing a pretty good job at growing on its own. "I've been gone so long, it's a different business," he laughs. Daughtry retired from IBM in 1994 after 37 years of service. And now part two of today's cover story, Lenovo's Grand Plan. This article is also by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from Morrisville. Since buying IBM's personal computer business for $1.75 billion in 2005, Lenovo Group Incorporated, Lenovo Group Limited, has focused its sales efforts on the company's homeland of China, but emerging now as a new target market, the Americas, and Morrisville is ground zero for the strategy. At play are more than personal computers, though. As PCs continually cede ground to smartphones, tablets, and other emerging intelligent devices, Lenovo must shift not only its tactics, but also its product lineup. The company has already announced it will roll out 3 tablet products in the spring. More announcements are in the offing, many of them brokered from the Triangle, that probably will include acquisitions. Still floating, for example, are reports that Lenovo has toyed with the idea of buying BlackBerry to jumpstart its entry into the smartphone sector, though movement on that appears to have stalled. Ramrodding Lenovo's North American operations is Jay Parker, newly appointed president of the region. He concedes the company's distant number 3 ranking in global sales of smart connected devices. In the U.S., with 2.6% of the market share, according to IDC, it doesn't even rank in the top 10. "Obviously, it means this is one of our largest growth opportunities anywhere in the world," Parker says, echoing a point that has been made by his boss, America's division president, Jerry Smith. The big question is how to move up in those rankings against the likes of Apple and Samsung, though that's expensive, one analyst has a theory. If Lenovo's been able to grow as rapidly as it has without a recent North American acquisition, imagine what would happen if the company started shopping. What I'm thinking is that we're going to have a U.S. acquisition, says Jean-Louis Lafferty, equity research analyst in G Asia. A North American push is a new one for Lenovo, Lafferty says. Following the acquisition of the IBM personal computer business, Lenovo retrenched and refocused on China, the source of 60% of the company's profit, he says. The fact is that their biggest market is China, where they completely dominate, so their base is growing very, very quickly, Lafferty points out, adding that an Asia-first focus has served the company well, so well that eyes can safely shift to more competitive markets, such as the U.S. That's, I think, where someone like Jay Parker and Jerry Smith can come in, says the analyst. I think they're going to try to focus on that. Change is indeed in the works. In addition to starting production this month in Whitsitt near Greensboro, the company dispatched Smith, one of its top operations executives, to Morrisville. The company then formed two groups, the Lenovo Business Group to encompass mainstream computer products and the Think Business Group to focus on premium products and enterprise solutions such as servers and storage. Both units would have a place in North Carolina's operations, says spokesperson Malanka Mukhi. As the company's strategy has shifted, the profile of the Morrisville operations has risen literally and figuratively. Once billed as Lenovo's North American headquarters, Morrisville is now the company's Americas headquarters. With its facilities at the Triangle, coupled with a growing presence in the Triad, Lenovo is creating an end-to-end presence in North Carolina that encompasses manufacturing, sales, and global operations. Not to mention the development of tactics and strategy, what with two top executives here. Lafferty says analysts were surprised last year to learn of the manufacturing expansion in North Carolina. I wasn't actually sure if it was a bit of a gimmick or for show, he admits, adding that the center proves Lenovo is betting on the U.S. The market has to continue to expand. It could be very costly for them to build in Whitsitt and then ship out. Could the end-to-end presence signal a possible public offering of stock for the Americas operation of Lenovo? Perhaps on a U.S. exchange? Maybe, Lafferty says. I think it's a little premature. But yeah, sure, why not in the future? To do it, the Americas business has to be grown and grown fast, which appears to be the company's intent. In the PC sector, Lenovo has proved its mettle by grabbing the trophy as the fastest-growing major PC company for 13 consecutive quarters. But, for perspective, consider that U.S. sales are a lowly 14% of worldwide sales. Parker says it's not just about the U.S., it's also about refocusing from PCs to all mobile-connected devices and growing all of its products, including servers and tablets. He wouldn't comment on acquisition possibilities. My main priority will be making sure that we're aligned in what our key strategic tenets are, and specifically that we're not allowing ourselves to be pleased that we're growing just in personal computers. Moving inside the front page, Tearing Down Academic Industry Walls by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. Partnerships between higher education institutions and private industry have come a long way in the past two decades, but there are still hurdles to overcome. Once the final barriers are torn down, experts believe companies could put themselves on a fast track for innovation if they form the right kind of alliances. America's research universities are hubs of innovation, NC State University Chancellor Randy Woodson told those gathered on February 26th for a summit on growth and economic development that he hosted in the new Hunt Library on Centennial Campus. We are in a time that is challenging but also brimming with opportunity. Now more than ever, we need to continue our investments in innovation and discovery, says Woodson. Woodson also pointed to North Carolina State's success in turning new technologies into businesses that create jobs and directly impact communities. Every year, NC State generates $1.7 billion in direct economic impact, says Woodson, noting that the university pumps $8 back into the economy for every $1 received in state funding. The importance of collaboration across disciplines within the university and across industry sectors outside the university is key to creating partnerships that will drive the economy. NC State researchers have spun off more than 100 companies that have attracted more than $1.5 billion in investment capital, Woodson says. In addition, NCSU's Office of Technology Transfer has helped university researchers obtain 795 active U.S. patents and more than 1,500 patents worldwide, with another 234 U.S. patents pending. Panelists discussed how partnerships between universities and the private sector have gone well as other areas that needed improvement. It's important to say that not everything is for the universities, says Stuart Whitman, director of the Eastman Innovation Center, part of the Eastman Chemical Company, headquartered in Kingsport, Tennessee. Fundamentally, universities want to disseminate information, while private industries want to protect intellectual property for profit. There are ways to work together, but Whitman says it's important to know what's out of bounds before even starting the conversation. University researchers must do a better job of innovating in areas in which there is an actual market pull. Too often, researchers want to push a new product for which there is no market, says Richard Corey, the executive director of the NCSU Biosciences Management Initiative and a Poole College of Management professor. He has started 12 companies and says he has learned this lesson. Conversely, private industry needs to ask better questions, he says. Industry leaders should come to university researchers with a specific problem, not something nebulous like, I want to cure cancer, says Curry. Also, university researchers are ready and available. That's the one thing Terry Lomax, Vice Chancellor for Research and Innovation at NCSU, says she wishes she could get out more. We, in academia, used to be hard to work with, I admit that, but it's not like that anymore, she says. Partnerships like the Biomanufacturing Training and Education Center have benefited companies in that industry cluster, says Michelle Sanders, general manager of the Biogen IDEC operations in North Carolina and an NCSU alumna. She said graduates from programs at the center receive the hands-on experience needed to work in a highly regulated industry, and as a result, we have a talent pool of highly skilled workers, Sanders says. Biogen IDEC is headquartered in Weston, Massachusetts, and the company employs 1,050 off Davis Drive in the Research Triangle Park. Next up, Sides on Board for Payday TIF by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. With a bill in the General Assembly reconstituting the payday lending industry in North Carolina, Jamie Fulmer, an executive with Spartanburg, South Carolina-based Advance America, has journeyed into the state to start a conversation. It's a trip carrying both economic and symbolic implications. On the dollar side, should the measure S-89 actually work its way through the Republican-controlled legislature, Fulmer's company and its competitors stand ready to reinvest millions of dollars in the state to make even millions more. As for symbols, the legislative crack in the door has let in a narrow shaft of light in a state that was one of the first in the nation to expel such firms and their storefront offices nearly a decade ago under the charge of predatory lending. Fulmer, for one, wants to put a foot in the crack. We just want to start a conversation, he says. We believe there is strong support in this state for a product that is both state and federally regulated. On the very day he arrived in the Triangle during the week of February 25th, however, Fulmer was greeted by fresh evidence of the exact opposite. A new poll by Raleigh-based Public Policy Polling, PPP, reported that North Carolinians by 73% to 7% reject the payday lending revival, a staggeringly low level of support. I was struck by the fact that all demographic groups felt the same way about it. Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, men, women, it didn't seem to matter, says Jeff Shaw of the Raleigh-based NC Justice Center, which released the data. Fulmer, not to be outdone and labeling PPP's product a shallow attempt to make news, produces a poll of his own. In his survey, 75% of North Carolina voters want the borrowing choice. Payday loans, now being secured online by borrowers in the state, are generally used by people who need some quick cash to pay a bill, perhaps for such needs as rent or for car repairs. As filed by Archdale Republican Jerry Tillman, S89 would permit lenders to make loans up to a maximum of $500, charging maximum fees of 15% of the amount of cash advanced. Borrowers sign over coming paychecks as collateral or permit automatic withdrawals from their accounts. Multiplying a $15 fee on a two-week loan of $100 by 26, the amount of such loans possible in 12 months gives an annual percentage rate, APR, of well above 300%, the figure that was used by PPP in asking residents whether that was something they'd be willing to pay. Fulmer counters that virtually no one is taking out 26 loans in a single year, and that a similar APR would result by factoring out bank overdraft fees. Moreover, he says the proposed North Carolina enabling legislation includes various consumer protections. Opponents of the bill include Attorney General Roy Cooper, AARP, and Durham-based Center for Responsible Lending, CRL, which helped lead past campaigns against the industry. All of those protections have a trapdoor that payday lenders can use to take advantage of consumers, says CRL's Chris Kolka. I think there is a lot of discussion going on in their ranks about this. And now McGregor Village looks for its future. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, and this article is from Carrie. For nearly 30 years, the Jimmy V's Steakhouse at McGregor Village Shopping Center in Cary has played host to hundreds of corporate and wedding dinners, holiday parties, and dinners out for an evening. But Jimmy V owner Terry Pegram is unsure how much longer the restaurant will be able to last when, and if, a new owner of McGregor Village takes over. "We've been told so many different stories in the last year or so, we've been treading water, more or less," says Pegram, who opened the restaurant about the time McGregor Village opened in 1986, and named it in honor of famed NC State University basketball coach, the late Jim Valvano. Indianapolis-based Simon Property Group has owned McGregor Village since 2001, but it has been years since the real estate company has put any real investment into upgrading the neighborhood center. Simon also owns mall properties across the country, including South Park in Charlotte. Sources say Simon is negotiating with Raleigh auto dealer David Johnson, owner of Johnson Automotive, to sell the 21-acre McGregor Village property at the intersection of US 1 and US 64. Planners with the town of Cary have reviewed a pre-application from Johnson Automotive proposing plans to relocate its Hyundai dealership to McGregor Village site, says Dan Mathis, communication and information planner for the Cary Planning Department. Mathis says part of the plan includes leaving some of the existing McGregor Village restaurants and shops, but isn't sure if Johnson intends to move forward with the plan or not. The McGregor Village property has a tax value of $13.3 million, according to Wake County records. Johnson did not return a call for comment. Les Morris, a spokesman for Simon Property Group, would neither confirm nor deny that the company is trying to sell McGregor Village. "It's our policy not to comment on sales or acquisitions," he says. Johnson Automotive owns the Johnson Hyundai and Johnson Subaru of Cary dealerships on Old Raleigh Road, about a half mile west of the McGregor Village Shopping Center. It also owns two Lexus dealerships, one in Raleigh and one in Durham, as well as the Johnson Autoplex on Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. Pegram says the Jimmy V's Steakhouse has been out of its lease contract with Simon for at least 3 years and has been paying rent month to month with no guarantee of what the future holds for the center. "Honestly, they haven't told us anything, but it's my understanding that, yes, Johnson wants to buy it," Pegram says. "The shopping center is in such disrepair, we've been hoping that someone would buy it and take it over, not demolish it. A year ago, it was Costco Wholesale Retailer that was looking to buy the McGregor Village Shopping Center. Representatives of Costco submitted a preliminary development plan to the Cary Planning Department, seeking approval to build a 150,000-square-foot Costco store on the site. But residents and members of the nearby McGregor Downs Country Club and other communities protested, and Costco withdrew its plans. The McGregor Village Shopping Center has, in the past couple of years, lost several key tenants, including the Tuesday morning discount gift and home accessory store, and the bridal gallery at McGregor Village store that was moved to another location on Tryon Road in Cary. The center was about 50% vacant in the fourth quarter 2012, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey of commercial real estate buildings. McGregor Village has about 130,000 square feet of retail space and 25,000 square feet of office space. Still open are Jimmy V's Steakhouse, McGregor Draft House, and Tony's Bourbon Street Oyster Bar, as well as the headquarter offices of Silver Chair Learning Systems, a company that trains professionals in the senior care industry. Horticultural Asset Management, which provides claim support information to the insurance industry on tree damage and landscape losses, and Block & Associates Realty. Continuing inside the Triangle Business Journal, Pantry works on tweaks to fuel pricing to boost profits, by Chris Bagley. This article is from Cary. The Pantry is introducing a new system for pricing the fuel it sells at its 1,600 stores in the southeastern United States. The company says the new system will help it optimize the amount of fuel it sells and the profit on those sales. Executives for the Pantry told analysts on a February 5th conference call that the Cary-based company is testing the system at several hundred of its stores and will have it in all 1,570 of its stores by the end of the second fiscal quarter in late March. Corporate controller Barry Epley compared the new system to the KSS fuel system the Pantry has been using in recent years at its Kangaroo Express-branded stores. The KSS system gathers the data that's going on in the marketplace, Epley says on the call. The price optimization program we're using takes that data and it optimizes both the gallons and the CPG. CPG is an industry term for cents of profits per gallon of fuel. The upgraded pricing software is important because it could help the Pantry maintain its sales volume despite pressure from frugal drivers, Raymond James analyst Ben Brownlow wrote in a research note after the call. That could conceivably entail slightly lower prices at some or all of its stores. People in the industry say gasoline stations have faced growing challenges in the last couple of decades as wholesale fuel prices have become more volatile. Sophisticated pricing systems can help gas station chains maintain an acceptable profit margin when wholesale prices are shooting up. While relatively large independent companies like the Pantry can negotiate long-term contracts with oil refiners such as British Petroleum, the refiners' sheer sizes give them tremendous market power when gas stations have to come back to buy fuel on the current spot market. When wholesale prices fall, though, a sophisticated system can help a company increase its profit margin or go after competitors' customers, depending on how the company's strategic goal. Gas stations don't necessarily prioritize profit margins on fuel because it's largely seen as a way to attract customers who buy higher-margin products such as cigarettes, beverages, and snacks. You don't want to be behind the curve on the way up or on the way down, says Jeff Leonard, Vice President for Industry Advocacy on the National Association of Convenience Stores. Fuel's importance in bringing its foot traffic shows up in the Pantry's financials. It accounted for 78% of the Pantry's $8.3 billion revenue in its 2012 fiscal year, but only 26% of its gross profit, according to the company's annual report. In contrast to the prices of cigarettes and other merchandise sold inside, fuel prices are visible from the street and are often the focus of intense competition. Customers probably can't tell you what they paid for a gallon of milk or a loaf of bread, but they are cognizant of what gas costs, says Gary Harris, executive director of the North Carolina Petroleum and Convenience Marketers, a trade group located in Raleigh. And now, from the real estate column from Amanda Jones Hoyle. Smithfield's returns to the growth mode. In Cary, it's been a decade since Smithfield's chicken and barbecue restaurant chain had anything that resembled a growth spurt, but the company is prepping to open at least four additional locations in 2013. Smithfield's, known for its Eastern North Carolina-style pork barbecue, fried chicken, and Brunswick stew, will open its first location in North Raleigh in the summer, confirms Smithfield's operations director, Richard Averett. He says the company will open a new structure in Rocky Mount in April that will replace the building destroyed in a fire last fall. Also on tap are new restaurants in the Brunswick County town of Shallotte near the coast in the fall and one in Greensboro in June. We last had a big growth spurt in 2003, so this is an exciting time for us, Averett says. Both the Greensboro and the Rocky Mount locations will be company-owned restaurants, Averett says, while the North Raleigh and Shallotte locations will be owned and operated by franchisees. Smithfields currently has 33 locations, all in eastern North Carolina. The company is operated by Cary Kaiser Incorporated, based in Cary. Also on the real estate column, there are plans in the work to save a historic Raleigh home. It looks like the historic Crabtree Jones House, circa 1795, will be saved after all. Area preservationists were concerned last fall that the federal-style plantation house, located on a hill off Wake Forest Road near the I-440 Outer Beltline in Raleigh, would be demolished to make way for a luxury apartment community planned for the site. But since then, officials with Preservation North Carolina and the Raleigh Historic Development Commission have been working on a plan to move the house to a nearby lot and renovate it. The Raleigh City's Council's Budget and Economic Development Committee gave its blessing at a meeting February 12th to issue a $100,000 loan from its Preservation Revolving Loan Fund to help buy a lot to which the house would be moved. The group is also soliciting funds from other charitable organizations. Myrick Howard with the Preservation North Carolina estimates the entire project would cost $600,000, and they hope to sell the house for around $300,000. This week's healthcare column by Jason DeBrun has an ER expansion eyed in Sanford. The Central Carolina Hospital in Sanford has applied to undertake a $13 million project to renovate and expand its emergency department. If approved, the hospital would increase its emergency treatment areas from 15 to 24 and add various other upgrades to improve quality and speed of care. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services regulates health care providers through its Division of Health Service Regulation. That division reviews the proposed project, determines if there is sufficient need to support the project, and rules on the application. In 2012, CCH recorded $737,000 of income after taxes on $69 million of patient revenue. Hospital officials project those figures to increase to $1.2 million of income on $97 million of patient revenue in 2019. The existing emergency room has 15 rooms, including 8 minor examination rooms and 2 trauma beds. The hospital has 10 credentialed emergency physicians. Decreasing patient wait time from arrival to encounter with a physician in the ER is one of the quality goals of CCH, according to the hospital. By that, it sets a door-to-doctor time of 30 minutes or less. Emergency care is one area in the American health care system that drains an enormous amount of money. Hospital emergency departments accept nearly anyone that comes through their doors, usually without verifying if those patients can pay for the care they are about to receive. When those patients can't pay, hospitals have to write those costs off as charity care or bad debt and have to make up for those losses in other areas. Even if a patient can pay, hospital officials say too many patients come to the ER when their health problems could be treated in a less acute and less expensive setting. In addition, because North Carolina lacks sufficient mental health care facilities, emergency departments are overrun with patients suffering from mental illnesses or health-related problems stemming from a mental health problem. Crowding is also an issue. The U.S. Institute of Medicine declared emergency room crowding to be a national epidemic. Crowding is associated with higher morbidity and mortality, delayed pain control, and inferior health care, determined by a group led by Elaine Rabin, an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. Now, from the column on energy by Chris Bagley, bean counters prep for FASB rule changes. This article is from Raleigh. The accounting regulators are considering new rules for how companies account for what customers owe changes that will temporarily make their profit look smaller. The Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, the private sector organization that writes the regulations, proposed the 154-page stack of rules in mid-December and is seeking accountants' feedback through April. The proposed rules call for a creditor to write down the value of certain receivables as soon as it records them in its books to reflect the possibility that the debtor could default at some point in the future. Receivables are assets for banks and other creditors, and they include everything from the short-term credit that suppliers extend to customers to loans that a bank makes to its borrowers. Accounting standards have long required an investment fund, for example, to write down the value of municipal bonds it's holding when it gets evidence that declining property tax revenue may force a city to default. Under the new rules, the fund would have to write down the bonds by some small fraction when it buys them to reflect the off chance that the city will default at some point in the future. Such write-downs go on the books as expenses, and they'll have the effect of forcing the company to show smaller profit, albeit temporarily, on the financial statements it releases to its own investors. Accountants say the rules could force some creditors to use more sophisticated and expensive forecasting software. Each company would have to base the size of its write-downs on industry-wide data as well as on specific factors such as its own history of collections, says Dwayne Southern, team leader for Grant Thornton's LLP's technology practice in the Carolinas. Southern notes that the companies in most industries extend credit to their customers, usually requiring payment within 30, 60, or 90 days, though discounts of 1% to 2% are also common as incentives for immediate payment. Still, financial services companies are likely to be most heavily affected because their main assets are loans, leases, and other financial products whose value depends on customers paying for years into the future. The banks are really going to be hit, says Heather Snyder, a partner with Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP in Raleigh. Moreover, banks and other financial firms will have to discount those streams of payments to their present value, a process that takes account for the effects of inflation, Snyder says. The proposal aims partly to bring U.S. accounting rules more to in line with the rules used in other industrialized countries. Moreover, FASB spokeswoman Chris Klimnick says some aspects of the proposal reflect accounting already used in most companies. Next up, under the column Spotlight on Entrepreneurs, we have an article by Lauren K. Onisorge, Making Sense of Sentences is the Goal of an App, from Chapel Hill. Jamie Markham uses technology to fight for justice. No, he's not a cape-wearing superhero. He's a smartphone-wielding professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Markham is developing a mobile application to improve the accuracy and consistency of North Carolina's ever more complicated criminal sentencing process, and if successful, he might as well don that cape for the lawyers and judges whose headaches he might lessen. There are 30,000 sentences entered a year in North Carolina just for felonies, he explains. Anything that can help the judges and prosecutors and lawyers do that quickly and accurately, that's the kind of thing that at the School of Government we try to help them do. Markham says the Department of Public Safety auditors catch about 1,000 incorrect terms each year, cases in which a judge has entered a sentence that is longer or shorter than what's allowed by law. He blames much of the sentencing confusion on complicated statutory charts, also known as sentencing grids. In 1994, the grids were developed to provide judges with options in the types and lengths of sentences that are appropriate, but revisions have muddled the grid. Depending on the date of an offense, different sentences might apply. Markham says it can take months or years for a case to work its way through the judicial system. Sometimes people have more than one charge that they are being sentenced for, so a single defendant might be sentenced for multiple crimes, and the judge would need a different version of the law for each crime. Imagine if, instead of squinting over multiple grids, you could simply plug parameters into your iPhone. This would bring all of that information together, he says. And while this specific tool is being developed in North Carolina, it could one day be applied to other states. Markham won UNC's 2012 C. Felix Harvey Award to advance institutional priorities, a prize of $75,000. That money is funding his app project. He does have help. A committee of legal professionals has been assembled that includes Alan Badur, a Superior Court judge who attests that it has become increasingly difficult to render a proper judgment. I feel confident that this app will save the state of North Carolina money by reducing the number of resentencing hearings, which take court time, attorney time, and often involve the transportation of inmates, he wrote in a statement. The app, which is being developed for both the iOS and Android operating systems, is targeted for a December release, and Markham says the team is about 25% of the way there. It's no substitute for the human element of sentencing, he cautions. Rather, it will be designed to help free up some judges' time so they can spend more time thinking about the best way to do justice in each case. Still under the spotlight for Entrepreneur's Column, TSF heads into year two with momentum. This article is by Lauren K. Onisorge and is from Durham. Triangle Startup Factory is rounding out its first year in operation, ready to welcome a new class of entrepreneurs, says co-founder Dave Neal. We started this thing almost exactly a year ago, Neal says, noting that at least 10 of the 11 TSF companies are still around, and many are readying to launch fundraisers. Just ask Liet Bellinson, part of the latest class with her company, AI Patents. In 3 months, we should close around, she says, adding that, without the advice of TSF, it's not a step for which the company would be prepared. So what sets TSF apart from other entrepreneurial feeders, such as Hub Raleigh and Launch Chapel Hill? For starters, it's the focus, says Neil. The first governing principle is software, information software, internet companies, he says. Because we don't know anything about medical devices or any kind of biotech, so really software has to be part of it. And to be considered, companies have to have at least two founders. In the ideal situation, they need to have a developer, a technical person, and they also need to have someone who is a community manager. The biggest separator, however, is the funding. Thanks to an undisclosed limited partnership group in California, Neil and TSF's co-founder, Chris Hevely, netted $6.64 million over a four-year period. Companies receive $50,000 in seed capital in addition to mentorship. More than 100 companies apply for each class, and six are typically accepted. We had our most productive, most difficult application process this time, Neil says. I think we're really optimistic about what's coming in. Involving companies are in several different stages. Incoming companies are in several different stages. We have had companies that were ideas only, he says. We've also had companies that already had a product out there. But when they are ready to graduate, they've made rapid progress. And they have a cushion with which to come by that proof, whether it's revenue or a hyped prototype. We put more money in than most accelerators around the country, so our companies are intended to use that time to get more proof, he says. They get enough money from us and other sources to really focus on getting a few dozen customers before going out and trying to raise money. TSF has its roots in a conversation between Hevely and Neil in 2009. Hevely was touring the Triangle, toying with the idea of launching an accelerator. He did 275 lunches and coffee in that year, and I was one of the later ones, Neil says. 2 years later, when Neil was ready to move his career in a different direction, he called Hevely, who had been active in Washington, D.C., with another accelerator called Launchbox Digital. And, he said, it just happened. This week's Washington Watch with Kent Hoover. The U.S. Chamber and AFL-CIO agree. The prospects for immigration reform improved when the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO announced they have reached agreement on how to create a visa program for low-skilled workers. Their agreement on this issue makes it more likely that a guest worker program, something President Barack Obama has not included in his immigration plan, will be included in an immigration reform legislation. Plus, the support of these two powerful organizations could lead more members of Congress to vote for the bill. Among tenets agreed to is that American workers have first crack at available jobs. Under the essential benefits rule, the federal government issued a 149-page rule that defines the essential health benefits that insurers will have to offer on new insurance exchanges in 2014. Among essentials are mental health and substance use disorder services, coverage that isn't offered currently in most individual health insurance plans. But the rule allows the overall essential health benefits package to vary from state to state. The rule defines four tiers of coverage that will be offered to small businesses and individuals through the insurance exchanges that are scheduled to be up and running in 2014 based on the percentage of health care costs that the plans will cover. And finally, on the regulatory costs that are saved, small businesses were spared $2.4 billion in first-year regulatory compliance costs in 2012, says the Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy. The office makes sure that federal agencies analyze the economic impact their proposed rules would have on small businesses and consider alternatives that would be less burdensome. For example, the office persuaded safety regulators to make additional modifications to its new hours of service rule in order to meet the concerns of small trucking companies. These changes saved small businesses $815 million a year, according to that office. This week's column, The Editor's Notebook, is by Sukheta Mukherjee, and he is the editor for the Triangle Business Journal. This column is entitled, Mayor is Half Right. By now you know that Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer told her employees who work from their homes, you need to find a Yahoo office near you and work from there. Folks like Donald Trump agree with Mayer. And proponents of telecommuting and flexible workplaces, such as Virgin's Richard Branson, argue that Mayer is taking the workplace back to the 1980s. A 2011 U.S. Department of Labor report found that about a quarter of employed workers work at least a few hours at home every week. The Society of Human Resource Management estimates that 53% of U.S. employers offered flexible work options in 2012, and that number has been going up in recent years. So is Mayer trying to buck this trend? Not really. Mayer knows that with a country that has an unemployment rate of 9%, if people working from home don't want to come to the office, that's just fine. There's a line of people outside her office just waiting to get in and do whatever it takes to get a job. Conversely, Mayer may be barking up the wrong tree if collaboration and productivity are the big issues. First, collaboration. If her argument that having everyone in the office all the time will help in collaboration and innovation, then companies such as Cisco and IBM must be doing a really bad job. About 40% of Cisco employees are not in the same city as their manager, and on average, they telecommute 2 days a week. At IBM, company officials say 29% of Big Blue's 128,000 employees are in a flex work or work at home schedule, saving 6.4 million gallons of fuel and 50,000 metric tons of carbon emissions. Second, productivity. It really does not matter just how many hours an employee is working. What matters is whether that employee is doing what is asked of him or her. If the duties and responsibilities are clearly defined, Mayer should not have to worry about where people are working. She should be able to quantify the performance. If that's not acceptable, she can go to the line outside her door and select her newest employee. Not to mention, does she really know how much the folks who work in the office are wasting time by going to Facebook, Twitter, ESPN, The Onion, and YouTube? I'll bet if one adds up all the wasted hours, it is much higher than what people waste working from home. Mayer is right in her decision in a couple of instances, however. There is no doubt that face-to-face meetings offer a better chance for innovation, creativity, and solutions. Emails generally set up a hierarchical thread that becomes cumbersome and time-consuming. Also, parties in face-to-face meetings are definitely in the game. They are vested, for good or bad. Emails, video conferences, go-to meetings somehow always creates a two-dimensional aspect to a conversation. As the numbers noted above show, this country was definitely headed towards a flexible path, keeping the employees' wishes in mind. Mayer may have brought that train to a sudden halt. And folks at JCPenney, Macy's, and Belk are not happy either. Pajama sales are on their way down. But maybe they will sell more suits and skirts. This week's guest column is Mr. John Hood. Mr. Hood is president of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. This column is entitled, North Carolina's Progress Requires Faster Growth. During the years that North Carolina was riding high, particularly during the 1980s and the 1990s, state policymakers wrung their hands about the problems associated with a fast-growing, successful economy. Rapid economic growth meant greater demand for public services, such as infrastructure and education, they argued. It posed risks to the state's air and water resources, and because economic growth wasn't equally distributed, it exacerbated long-standing differences between the metropolitan areas and rural counties. I suspect that many of these fretful policymakers would welcome a return of the days of rapid economic growth, as it has become evident that the public policy problems associated with a lackluster economy are much worse. North Carolina's relatively weak job and income growth, for example, is making it harder for governments to finance long-term public investment. On the revenue side, it means less money coming into state and local coffers per North Carolina resident. At the same time, a weak economy boosts demand for consumption subsidies such as unemployment insurance and Medicaid that trade off with public investment. So, if you think North Carolina spends too little on public infrastructure or education, your goal can't realistically be met without stronger economic growth. And if you think I've got the causality wrong, that spending more on infrastructure or education would make the economy stronger, your quarrel is with the time-space continuum, not with me. If spending more tax dollars on education boosts the economy, it does so in the long run by improving the skill level of future workers, professionals, and entrepreneurs. Government is not a magical income generation machine. It involves taxing money out of households and businesses, money that would otherwise be spent or invested privately. In the short run, if you think it's wise to set aside more money for public investment, you will find it much easier to accomplish when the economy is growing. More people are employed, households are receiving real of inflation-adjusted increases in annual income, and public assistance isn't taking as big a bite out of state revenues. The main levers that state and local policymakers can operate to boost economic growth in the short run involve the cost of doing business in the private sector. If by reforming taxes and regulations they increase the real rate of return on investing in new plants, equipment, and personnel in North Carolina, more businesses will expand or set up shop here. I'm not saying that average economic growth is the only thing politicians need to care about. Even during North Carolina's boom years, there were some boats in dry dock that didn't float with the rising tide. Factors such as out-of-wedlock births, drug and alcohol abuse, the poverty cycle, educational mediocrity, insufficient work experience, and inadequate training in personal finance limit upward mobility. Government is not the only institution for addressing these issues, and in many cases does more harm than good when it tries. But to the extent public policy can influence decisions about matters of personal behavior or morality, it is more likely to be successful in a climate of robust growth rather than in the current economic malaise. Can measures such as tax reform and regulatory reform really affect North Carolina's rate of economic growth? Empirical evidence and recent experience gives us good reasons to be optimistic. As discussed in 2012's Our Best Foot Forward, there are dozens of academic studies demonstrating links between taxes, regulation, and rates of job creation, entrepreneurship, and income growth. A 2011 study released by the National Bureau of Economic Research, for example, found that state spending on Medicaid and other public assistance was linked to slower economic growth, while lower, simpler taxes were associated with faster growth, after adjusting for other factors. On regulation, most studies showed a negative effect on economic growth, with the strongest effects for manufacturing industries, new firms, and small businesses. Economic growth is not, strictly speaking, a panacea. It is necessary, but not sufficient. Without it, progress on North Carolina's other challenges is unlikely. With it, progress becomes possible. Well, it's pretty well known that SAS Incorporated founder Jim Goodnight has a high regard for his alma mater, North Carolina State University. As such, he seemed to feel free to get in a jab at rival UNC Chapel Hill at a summit on economic development hosted by NCSU on Tuesday. "I was accepted both here and at Carolina," he said to a crowd that included NC Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. "And thank God I came here, because they have real classes here." There were several NCSU alums in the crowd, and Goodnight's comment got the loudest cheers of the afternoon. Lockout, smockout. Caniacs aren't bothered. At the turnstile, a good year is shaping up for the Carolina Hurricanes so far, though only 7 games had been played through February 27th of 24 scheduled at the PNC Arena. A total of 128,273 people had shown up. That's an average attendance of 28,324, or 98.1% of the building's capacity. That's good for 14th in the 30-team league. Last season's the Canes finished the season 22nd in the league with an average turnstile count of 16,042, 86.6% of capacity. Leading the National Hockey League at the gate are the Redhawks Chicago Blackhawks, who are filling their building to 109% capacity. Shh, don't tell the fire marshal. With an average gate of 21,573. Fighting it out for last place are the New York Islanders, now penultimate with an average of 13,144, and the Phoenix Coyotes at 13,142. We'd like to announce an icon of Triangle Development has died. Andrew Andy Karras, who developed one of the first shopping centers in Chapel Hill, died February 21st at the age of 90. A native of Charlotte who served in World War II, after which he enrolled at UNC Chapel Hill and played football alongside the legendary Charlie Choo Choo Justice, Karras built Eastgate Shopping Center in 1965. Through his career, he built about 60 shopping centers scattered from Canada to Florida, according to the Chapel Hill News. Ever impeccably dressed, Karras was one of the first members of Carolina's Athletic Boosters Club, the Rams Club, and was a fixture of Tar Heel football and basketball games as recently as January of this year. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen to us at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.